Hello, everyone, and welcome to a new episode of the Marketplace Discussions podcast. My name is Mahmoud Resmi, and today's guest is Megan Preston-Meyer. Megan spent over 10 years working in supply chain and analytics. Now she focuses on the stories that the data does not tell. She's recently published her first novel, Firebrand, which is part of a series called Corporate Elements Mysteries. The first book is about the protagonist, Current, who's a fresh MBA graduate. She lands her first job in the corporate world, but then she has to deal with all sorts of personal problems, complex peer relationships, office politics, as well as an ethical dilemma. The novel is funny, lighthearted, it's existential, it's highly relatable, and it's thought-provoking. I urge you to buy a copy of the novel, and I hope you enjoy today's conversation. If you have any questions, make sure to leave them in the comments section below if you're on YouTube, or you can reach out to me at decafquest on Twitter via DM. I hope you enjoy the conversation. Thank you very much for listening. And if you want to keep up with future episodes, make sure to click on the subscribe button. Thank you again, and see you around. Thank you very much for agreeing to do this. We have been scheduling this or trying to do something like a podcast for the past year, if I'm not mistaken. It was initially a marketplace discussion. And afterwards, I'm like, okay, not now, you were busy. Finally, the reason why we're doing this podcast now is because you have a new book coming out soon, July 11th, if I'm July not mistaken. 11th.
A week from when we're recording this.
Yeah, July 4th. And I did not know anything about the book before you sent it to me. I know the title. I knew the title was Firebrand, and I saw the cover, but that was it. So I didn't even know whether it was going to be a fiction or a nonfiction book. But then I started listening to it, and I got hooked. And I finished it in 2 days. So I listened to the first half, and then the second half. And I've been thinking about it ever since, because you cover so many interesting topics from the corporate world, the typical graduate, MBA graduate who's trying to get into the real world to solve real world problems, but then comes or faces so many problems, ethical issues, imposter syndrome, dealing with difficult bosses and colleagues, etc., etc. So just because I want to write like some sort of short review or a blurb eventually, but then I'm trying to articulate my ideas here. It was interesting. That's all I can say for now. And we're going to be discussing the book today.
Interesting. So, I'll take it.
But it was really, really like I did not expect this, and it was fun. It's also because you added like this suspenseful, I don't know if we can, to what extent we can maybe add some spoilers, but then I'll try not to. But yeah, it was there, like it's suspenseful. There's some action there. There's some philosophical reflections. It's like, yeah, it's interesting stuff. So I don't know. Tell me about the book, about whatever you want to discuss.
Yeah. Wow. And I mean, first of all, like, I apologize to the like audio only listeners who can't see me just like beaming from ear to ear this whole time you were talking. Cause I don't know. I've never heard, you're the first person who's talked about my book before. And like, cause you're one of the first people to have read it. And so I'm super excited. I absolutely 100% meant to put every single one of those elements in there that you just listed. The philosophical discussions and like that. No, like, I don't know. I've been writing the book for a long time and it kind of just evolved. So, it was sarcasm. I didn't actually purposefully put in philosophical discussions, but, So the book has been, the book
it was even sarcasm. I mean, but the thing is, even the philosophical sarcastic commentary within the book itself is a philosophical commentary. So even if it was unintentional, it's
I'm interested. You said like it wasn't what you expected, so what, and you said you just didn't
because I did not know, like honestly, I did not know if it, like knowing you, I thought it would be fiction, but then for some reason I thought maybe it's nonfiction, maybe it's, I guess the question would be, to what extent is it autobiographical?
Quite a bit, at least in the beginning. So Current is the main character, Current Kepler, and she is a 25-year-old who gets her MBA and then gets her first real corporate job and then has to solve a mystery. And I don't recall having to solve any mysteries in my corporate career, but other than that, like I got my MBA when I was 25, I got a job, and then all of a sudden was, you know, I've vacillated between the super cocky, I know everything about the business world and I'm so much smarter than everyone else in this meeting and why are they so dumb? And then on the other hand, like, I have no idea what's going on and why does everyone else know what's going on? And like, how does anything actually get done in the world? And so a lot of Current is very autobiographical, and a lot of the like situations are also very true to life. Anyone in my LinkedIn, if you read the book, you're probably in there in some way, shape, or form. Like I used to keep notes. Like I had a little notebook that I would take with me to every single meeting, and I would write down, you know, I would write down the things that I was supposed to be writing down for the meeting, but then I would write down like, this is a jargony phrase, I'm going to use this in my book. This is a super absurd situation that just occurred, I'm going to use this in my book. And a lot of those actually made them in there. So it's fiction, but somewhat based on real life experiences.
Yeah. And there's the big disclaimer at the beginning whereby it's all fiction. It does not resemble any whatever company or people, but yeah, it's, so I'm in fact curious, before we dig deeper in the book and the themes and what got you to write it. First off, your journey is interesting because, as you mentioned, you finished your MBA, 25, got a corporate job. And then at one point in time, you decided, I'm going to quit.
Yeah. Yeah, so I got my MBA in operations management, and then I worked for about 10 years. I started off in supply chain and then moved more towards analytics. And I spent most of my career doing corporate analytics and insights and, you know, digging through data. And then about 3 years ago, I just decided, yeah, no, this is not what I want to do. And I gave myself a year to quit and to try and become a writer. And that was 3 years ago. And I'm sort of, well, no, I'm a writer. I can say I'm a writer. But I'm certainly not going to brush off my CV anytime too soon and go back to the corporate world until I have to. We're going to see how long I can stave that off.
Yeah. And you started by writing a book for kids, Supply Chain.
Yep. I've got two kids' books, picture books about supply chain. They're The Adventures of Supply Jane and FIFO. And I've got two of those. The third one is coming out later on this year. And they've been super fun. I had never written a kids' book before. And then I wrote one, and then I wrote another one, and now I've written a third one. And this somehow like put me on this track. I'm now an expert in recruiting Gen Alpha into supply chain and manufacturing industries. Wow. So if anyone needs a guest speaker, let me know, because I've done like one or two speaking events. So kind of stumbled into it.
It's not easy. I mean, writing books for kids is not easy. because we did explore the possibility of writing a stoicism book for kids. And I still have not forgotten that. But honestly, like it's difficult. Maybe probably with supply chain, it might be easy because the concepts can be relatable perhaps. But then when it comes to, I don't know what it is. Maybe I'm just overcomplicating things, like stoicism for kids. I feel like, oh my God, I don't want, it's too much responsibility to write something that kids will read or the parents will read for their kids. I don't know.
I think so what you said about overcomplicating things, that's probably it. That's the biggest thing that I've learned is that you don't, my two kids' books so far, they don't teach kids about supply chains as a whole. I mean, they both take tiny little concepts and just explain one little concept. So it's very bite-sized. The third book is going to, that one talks a little bit more about the whole, upstream, downstream supply chain, but I had to work my way up to that. And I think you don't need to try and compress everything you know about Stoicism into 24 pages with illustrations. Just take one little element. And, we should revisit this again. I mean, that was... We could do it.
Yeah. And well, at last year, was extremely hectic for me. But then now I have more time and more experience as well when it comes to making things more bite-sized. And this is a lesson I learned when it comes to teaching, preparing lectures, and in general, the designing courses. Because you're right. And this is, now that you're saying it, this is something I encountered and a problem I faced when I first started teaching, because I wanted to just cram everything into the syllabus. And an intro to philosophy course had so many philosophers. It's as though I was expecting the students to learn every single thing about every single thing philosophy had to offer. And then bit by bit with experience, I realized that I needed to have one idea for each lecture or each session or each a few ideas for each course in this case, and that's it. Focus on it and elaborate based off of that, and then see where the discussions go. And this is what made the sessions even better, especially for example with Stoicism. I would want to talk about death and desire and this and that, and now if you see my latest Stoic stuff, it's like, let's focus on two things, this and that, what we can control, what we can't, etc. So yeah, you're right. This is, but see, don't you think that the audience, be it if you're giving a talk or if you're writing a book, don't you think they would be expecting we're gonna learn about this in depth and detail? Or do you think they would expect that there's only one idea and we're going to be focusing on that? Don't you think they have different expectations? Because this is what I struggle with usually.
Well, for one thing, you can control the expectations. You can say that this is, depending on the title or the way you kind of talk about the book, because people aren't just going to pick up a book in the library and say, oh, wow, this, it mentions Stoicism. I bet I'm going to have the entire, the entire history and the entire, overview in these, within 5 minutes. So you can set the expectation that this is going to be, this is one element. And I mean, for kids, kids don't have expectations. If you're making a picture book, they just want there to be an illustration and a story. And, parents might have expectations, but that's something different. And I don't know, but this is interesting, because you've talked about, you said earlier that it was a lot of responsibility to try and teach kids something, and now you're talking about the expectations. So let's talk about that. What are these? Why do you feel all of this responsibility? I mean, you teach kids, right?
This is why. It's because I've seen the back end of running a business, addressing kids like a school, an online school in this case, or and I've taught at a school, a face-to-face school for a year, a few years back. And it's, see, this is why I'm talking about expectations, because you have, unlike a transaction with adults, where the adult is deciding whether or not they want this and they know what to expect. In this case, there are more players here. And so you have the parents, you have the kids, and then you have, depending, of course, if we're talking about the class, you have a class with kids. And so there are so many things going on at the same time, because first off, there are the dynamics between the kids. If you're having more abstract or discussions that can cause tension, and then you have the parents of the kids, and you know, so it creates several layers of responsibility insofar as you want to ensure that your that they're having discussions or thinking about different concepts, critical thinking, etc., without making it a bad experience for them or for their parents, etc. So it's difficult to have that.
Yeah, but I think this is, I've got a little bit of experience. Like, I don't have kids, you don't have kids, right? So neither of us really has much firsthand experience with this. But I've got these books, and then I've also taught kids like at Sunday school or like a youth group. And what I've, and like, that's a lot of responsibility, right? If I'm trying to, you know, stoicism is one thing, I'm trying to distill like Christianity into a like 12-minute session with a little PowerPoint presentation. And so what I've had to kind of tell myself is that like, it's not only me, like they will hear these things over and over again, no matter what you're teaching a kid, like no matter what you're teaching anyone, like learning happens over a lifetime, right? And so as long as you, I think that is really interesting though, what you said is like, you don't want to make it a bad experience. Cause so I think for me, as long as you're, you know, getting kids interested enough to come back to the subject or to not shy away from the subject, then you're like, that's, your job is done there, right? It's not just a transaction. So if kids are like, oh, supply chain stuff is interesting, or like inventory management stuff is not super incredibly boring, then the next time they hear about it, maybe they'll read a little bit more. And the next time a child is asked to critically think, if you haven't like completely made it a nightmare for them, they'll do it. And so it's not like you don't have the entire child's future on your shoulders. That's what I tell myself. So.
Yeah. It's just interesting because it's in general, I mean, in your case now, you're writing books, and you also, so do you write more particularly, not the kids books, but this, the novel in this case, Firebrand, did you write with a particular audience in mind, or was it more of a self-reflective activity and this is what came out?
I think somewhere in the middle. I didn't write it with an audience in mind, but it wasn't completely, I mean, yeah, it's semi-autobiographical, but it's also, it's not just like me journaling or like working out my own feelings, or if it is, it's like kind of hidden behind a veil of humor and I don't know, absurdity. So I write things that I think are funny. Like I write things that entertain me as much as possible. And then I sort of hope on the back end, if I can find other people who share my sense of humor, they'll like it too. And I will be completely honest, if I had more of the audience in mind, like there are a bunch of, since I'm self-publishing the book, now I've done all this research into self-publishing, and there's all these like genre tropes you're supposed to follow, and all of these, you know, if you're writing this type of book, it must follow this particular arc, and 30% of the way through the book, it must have an inciting event, and like there, it's very formulaic. And I looked at that stuff and was like, yeah, my book is not following this formula. And then I thought I could either completely tear it apart and make it follow this formula, or I could just put it out there and see what happens. And I settled on the latter because, yeah.
Yeah, it's self-publishing. It's a pretty tricky kind of world. So how did you, or how are you going to be doing that? Is it self-publishing as in just like I did with my Sardonically Speaking book, you'll post it on Gumroad, or did you have a different process?
I've got a little bit wider distribution network. So I'm publishing it on Amazon. And so that will be the Kindle version, and then the paperback, it will be available there. And then there's also another, there's a distribution company or distribution platform called Ingram. And so there it'll be available on like barnesandnoble.com and bookshop.org and basically anywhere. You know, when people say anywhere books are sold, like now I can say that because most bookstores access this distribution catalog. And so not like anyone can go to a bookstore and say, hey, can you please like order me Firebrand by Megan Preston Meyer? And they should be able to look in their system and get it, which like I had no idea that was an option. And I'm not sure that it was an option. Like, well, it wasn't an option for my kids' books, or at least I didn't think it was at the time. So I've learned a ton about self-publishing, more than I probably ever wanted to know, but it's not a super fun business. I think like most writers get into writing because they want to write, but at some point, if you want to sell a book, you also have to market it and distribute it.
Yeah. And it's, I don't know if it's a hard lesson or what. It's not. See, this is a thing, because in your case, again, it's the book and the other books you've already published. And in my case, it's courses and teaching. And at one point, I don't know if it's the resistance that you feel when it comes to marketing your stuff. Is it? Why is that? Why? Like, yeah, you enjoy writing. That's what you want to do. But then marketing can also be fun.
It can be fun. I think for me, it's this, you know, like there's a little bit of the, well, I don't want to, you know, talk about how great my book is. Like that's not, you know, I should be modest. And that's, I've gotten over that at least somewhat. But the problem with marketing is that especially on social media, right? It's just, you do all of this work and then it just goes into the ether and no one ever hears about it. And so it's, I think when you see results, marketing is super fun. But when you don't, when you like do all this and you're like, oh my gosh, this post that I just made, like this amazing graphic that I produced on Canva, and I'm going to put it out there into the world, and it gets like 7 impressions, and you're like, this is dumb. I'm done with marketing. Like, I'm just going to go hide and like, maybe I won't ever sell a book. So there's definitely the like peaks and valleys for marketing.
Yeah, it's also probably, see, this is a thing. You adopted a different kind of approach for this book and you're treating it differently. So the distribution channels in the marketplace, instead of maybe using just a Gumroad or any other platform where you can sell directly, I think this is already a marketing strategy in this case, because you have a wider audience for them to at least even know that the book exists, and this is extremely important. And from what I've learned from people like Hassan Osman is, and I've seen it with Nick Gray, who's also self-published a book, the 2-Hour Cocktail Party, is that it's extremely important on Amazon to get reviews.
Yeah.
At least the first few weeks. It's not as important as sales. So even if you have 5 sales, if you get 5 reviews, this is already going to be training the algorithm that this book there's some interaction and engagement with the book. And so it starts, you know, displaying it even more. So yeah, maybe this is something to think about.
Yeah, that's, I've heard that, I mean, the reviews are like, Amazon itself is, it's a necessary evil. Like, it's such a horrible thing. Like, you cannot self-publish without Amazon, even with wider distribution, but it's, I mean, you have to appease the algorithm and you do all of this stuff and you have to, you know, like, there's all of these, for one thing, there's a whole cottage industry based on like helping you select the right keywords, and you can pay. Like, I've had so many people, like so many messages on Instagram saying like, hey, we'll review your book on, you know, like, we'll leave you a good review, a 5-star review on Amazon for only like $25. I'm like, I'm not going to pay for reviews. Like, I would rather be forever in obscurity than to like pay. And I don't know, like, how much worth is a $25 review going to get me anyway? Like, it's probably going to be poorly written or written with ChatGPT. And yeah, based on the royalties that I would make from a book sale, I'd have to sell a whole bunch of books just to afford that one terrible review. So no, that's not in my marketing plan.
Yeah, no, but not that. But then you'll have to probably pester your friends and anyone who buys the book, and you'll be like, yeah, hey,
yeah,
how about you leave a review, or I'll show up at your place. And
yeah, well, and as we talked about, like, you know where everybody is at any given moment. So I'll just ask you for their addresses and go knock on the door.
Yeah, I'll do that for you. Don't worry, because I really like the book. It's really, really interesting, and there's a lot of food for thought, and it's just it's curiously a light listen. Again, I listened to the audiobook, so this is already a good strategy, like the audiobook, which you recorded yourself. That's good.
The audiobook was so much fun. You should make sure, you should definitely do an audiobook for, I mean, you could go back and record Sardonically Speaking, and then for your, like, for your business philosophy book, like, do an audiobook.
Yeah. Yeah. No, the Sardonically Speaking thing was just an exploration. Like, it was just a cathartic kind of activity I undertook, and that was it. So it's okay. There. That's why I'm not even marketing it that much. It did its job, and now I have a different style. I've developed a different kind of writing style, etc., etc. So yeah, things are different, but definitely I'll consider that if I end up writing the Philosophy for Business Leaders book.
When, not if.
When, yeah. Okay, that's already an interesting, also, yeah, maybe a few tips for those before, again, we'll before discussing a few things, but some tips for those of us who are trying to write a book, a more, between brackets, serious book, like with research and etc.
Are you asking me for tips on how to write a serious book?
Because you're already, written. I mean, you have experience. You've done your research with self-publishing. I already know some tips. You went on Shut Up and Write, for example.
Yeah, no, that's probably my biggest tip is, it's super trite, but if you want to write a book, you have to actually write a book. And for me, that's the biggest, like, that's the hardest part. Like, it sounds, it's super cliche, and it's, you know, how many millions of blog posts and like inspirational messages are out there saying like, you just have to sit down and write, but it's super hard. Like, I am right now I'm in a hotel in Austria. I took myself on a writing retreat to start working on the sequel to Firebrand. And I have, as of this morning, I've been here for 2 days. I have 497 words. So, like, and that's not very many. Like, I have not, like, writing is so hard to actually sit down and do it, because there are a million things you can procrastinate with. There, like, I like to think about writing a lot more than I actually like to write. So if you want to write a book, write. And the thing, like what you mentioned, Shut Up and Write, this is one of the best tools that I found. It's a shutupright.com, I think is what it is. And basically what they are Zoom sessions where you sign on for an hour. There's like 6 to 30 people, depending on which session you're on. You all just go around and you say, hi, like, I'm so-and-so, and today I'm going to be working on chapter 7, or today I'm going to be working on an outline for a blog article. And then you go on mute and everyone just writes for an hour. But there are people like in the corner of your screen who, you know, like won't actually know if you're on Twitter instead of writing, but you feel like they would know. And so you have sort of that social pressure. And that is, I mean, it's accountability and it's productivity. And like, I swear by these. So shut up and write.
Yeah. Yeah, it's and see the when it comes to the entire process, because it's like it's difficult. You wrote like a I don't know, like, so it's how many words is the book? Do you know the
Firebrand? It's 40,000. So it's that for a novel is pretty short, but for me it was a lot.
Yeah, but no, but it's a no, there are many novels around 5 hours of audiobook length. It's 40,000 is just average, like, you know. Yeah, it's not short. And I think this is good, because it's first off Dostoevsky and 24 hours of audiobooks, or, you know, 1,000 pages. I mean, that's too much. But the idea is, it's difficult when it comes to actually materializing ideas into an actual plot. How did you, does it get boring at one point and then you feel like you need to finish the book?
There's definitely some of that, because, and so there are two camps when it comes to writing. There's the person who makes a super strict outline and knows exactly before they even, you know, write an entire grammatically correct sentence, they know bullet point wise exactly what's going to happen. And then there are people who just like will sit down with a blank Word document and just go and see what happens. And I'm sort of in the middle, where like I need to have some sort of idea. But and that's where I am with my second book right now, is like I have an idea of the plot. And then I know there are all these little elements that also need to be worked in there. And so I have kind of an idea of where I'm going. But at the same time, then sometimes I just get super bored with the outline. And again, I like to write. And so I will just sit down and write, even if it's only, you know, a scene, to sort of remind myself that I know how sentences work and doesn't have to just be in bullet points. So this is, again, I've heard a lot of different people with a lot of different opinions, and there is no one way to do it. And it's, as long as you're doing something, I think that's probably the most important thing. So if you feel like outlining, outline. If you feel like writing, write. Just keep moving.
Yeah, it's I'm thinking about the plot, and it can be a movie.
Yeah,
don't you think?
It could be. I could see it as a movie.
Yeah, have you
it would considered... be a very short movie.
No, I don't think so. I mean, hour and 30 minutes? It can be an hour and 30 minutes.
Yeah, I guess it could be. I don't watch movies, and so I don't really, like, movies are not my thing. So, like, I would be very happy if it, like, if anyone wants the rights, like, contact me. But.
Yeah, it's an interesting business philosophical rom-com.
That, I think you just made up a new genre. I'm going to go to Amazon and readjust my, like, where it's listed. Put it in.
Because it's like it has all these elements which are extremely interesting. Like, you know, so it's just for those who are Listening, it's again without spoilers. So, off the top of my head, you have the existential crisis of someone who studied an MBA and now you're facing the real world, as we mentioned before. And then you're thinking about, there's an imposter syndrome kind of there. You're sitting at the table, and maybe you can tell us a bit more about the imposter syndrome and based on your experience. I definitely see this is why it's also relatable, because it doesn't only have to be MBA. I think all of us have experienced imposter syndrome on the one hand. At one point, you feel like everyone knows what they're talking about. I definitely were there with conferences, you know, and with other professors, etc. You're like, oh, they know what they're talking about. And deep down, no one knows. And then, you know, the people who all of a sudden show up in your life when something interesting happens, and you never know whether it's because they're interested or because of some sort of self-interest, and why and how. And then you have the dynamics of the office space, and you have the ethical issues. I don't know if you want to talk about the particular example of the ethical issues that arise there. But yeah, like I'm thinking about all these different elements that were there. And it's just, and then, you know, the startup-y and entrepreneurial kind of people, and then the more corporate people and the interaction between them. And it's interesting.
Yeah, no, thank you. Yeah, and I think there's a lot there. I don't know what we should talk about first, but I think the imposter syndrome stuff, that was one of my, that's probably the most, I like what you said about, you know, existential. That was probably one of the more existential elements, because there are a lot of instances that I think are super, I hope, relatable, but they're very realistic for me, where someone will say something, she will have this inner dialogue that's like, that's the stupidest thing I've ever heard. And then she will say, oh, wow, that's great. You know, and so it's just like she knows, and we all know when things are like, when they're dumb and when we're playing games and when things are just absurd. And yet, like, you have to be super strong to be the one who actually says, like, no, this is not a good idea. Or like, no, this is a terrible, like, this initiative will never work, so why are we even discussing it? No one says that, because they're going to be the ones that gets fired. But everyone, it's very emperor's new clothes-y sometimes, where everyone knows that things are a bad idea and no one says anything.
Yeah. And I'm trying to think about this from a, also, like, it's challenging ideas on the one hand, and this somehow relates to asking questions, right? And you don't want to be the naive person who shows up and says, like, so even if you're not saying, even if you don't want to say that it's a bad idea, or you just want to dig deeper to understand where this is coming from, to try to understand different perspectives, whether it's an idea or whether it's just, if everyone is speaking about something and then you're like, okay, but what does this mean? It's automatically, you already have this dialogue whereby I don't want to seem as though I'm the idiot who doesn't know what they're talking about.
Right.
And I don't want to make the derail the discussion, or, you know, waste their time, et cetera, et cetera. So it's, yeah, this is interesting. Like and
I have,
I'm trying not to derail the conversation here, right? But it's like, I'm interested to explore this further. The, not necessarily only the imposter syndrome, it's just the difficulty of the situation and how, maybe if you faced it, or if you are a current in this case, it's like how, it's a difficult situation.
That's a really difficult situation, because, and that is one of the places where imposter syndrome grows and just like blossoms, because you, on one hand, like you say, like you have no idea what's going on, but everyone else around you seems to. You don't want to pause and ask for clarification. And so then not only do you still don't know what's going on, but you see yourself acting like you know what's going on. And then like, then it's too late. Then you can never, ever ask a question again, right? Because like you should have asked for clarification the first time you heard of this. And if you didn't, then it's just, it would be even weirder. And so what I, like, I had a girl that I, or a woman that I worked with at one of my last jobs before I quit the corporate world. And she, like, she had exactly this problem. She said, like, I always, like, I never want to ask questions because I'm afraid I'll sound stupid. And I said, please, like, especially to me or to anybody, like, if you go in and ask someone a question that they know the answer to, you are doing them such a favor. Because that breaks this loop. Everyone in a meeting is sitting there trying to sound professional and sound smart and know what they're doing. And half of them have no idea. And so if you can go and like give them a softball question that they can answer very easily and get to be the expert and get to do you a favor, like they will love you forever. So it's actually very strategic to ask dumb questions.
Yeah, it's strategic to ask questions, but at the same time, don't. Have you ever been in a situation whereby asking a question backfired?
I'm sure I have. Nothing comes to mind, and I will be very honest. Like, I'm not very good at following my own advice. Like, I don't always ask for clarification, or like I try and figure things out on my own. And then, you know, like, but when I do, I don't know, most of the time, if you do ask a question, like no one brands you as dumb, or at least I don't, like, I have never had an experience where I asked a question and then never recovered from it.
Yeah.
Have you?
Not to the extent that I was not able to recover from it, but then sometimes I raise issues that are discarded as either unnecessary or it's just, like, for example, I was hosting a marketplace discussions. I mentioned this yesterday. George, and the idea was, so they're the bankers and they're talking about, you know, experience in the corporate world, etc., and investing and fundamentals and, you know, the macro economic analysis and stuff like that. And at one point I show up like an idiot, and I'm like, because they talk about something, so the presenter is talking about something and they're having this discussion in the Q&A about, I forgot what it is, and I bring up the ethics issue. And metaphorically speaking, they look at me or they write in the chat, like, yeah, let's just get this over with, like, who cares? So for example, so sometimes you ask, or it's not the questions itself, or the question itself, it's the topic that you bring up, whereby people are just not even interested in having in exploring this. So if you, this is kind of the dilemma that Kieran was having, right? When it comes to the ethical issue, is it ethics? Is it legal? And I'm not gonna get into details here. Let's just keep it for people to read. But so that you, no one gets confused. It's just an ethical issue that is brought up, or an issue that she faces and she doesn't know how to handle it. And the question here is, should I bring it up with my boss? Should I talk to HR? Is it even an ethical issue? Do I even care? And this is the dilemma that she faces. And at one point, I like this, I even quoted that to you. It's like, let me go back to it so I don't mess it up. But that was interesting. Like, She, where is it? There you go. She hadn't been taught anything more concrete than the trolley problem. And so she had taken a business ethics class at in the during the MBA days, and that was pretty much it. So this dilemma of bringing something up and then thinking, well, people might not care, and then how will you, will this cost you your job? Will this get you fired, etc.? So it's not easy, especially when it's something as serious as a possible ethical dilemma.
Yeah, yeah. No, this one, this is hard. And this is, I mean, the example that you gave when, you know, it's bankers or it's somebody and they're just trying to shove you aside and, you know, ethics is more of a nuisance than anything. That, I think that's probably a much more realistic or much more everyday concern. Current's concern is, you know, like, yeah, there's an actual ethical issue. What do you do? Because like in my MBA, I took a corporate ethics class and I got the lowest score that I got in the entire program. I got a B+, which in MBA terms is like an F, because yes, everyone gets an A or an A-. And that was because I tried to be realistic on my essays. And I was, you know, and the correct answer was always and without fail, like, no, you must do what is right for the environment, even if that puts your company out of business. Like, and so I was trying to figure out, you know, like, no, maybe we can use some of our profits to like clean up this, I don't know, swamp that we're polluting, whatever it was in the case study. And the correct answer was no, basically, like that, no, like it was a super like sunshiny, like unrealistic. The view of corporate ethics that I got in my MBA was, I think it was so unrealistic that it didn't prepare anybody for anything they would ever see in reality.
Whoa. Tell me more about it, please, because
this it was long, a very long time ago, so I maybe don't remember it entirely.
No, but that's because no, but this is what if this is what stuck with you, this is already
that's an issue. Yeah, like that is,
but
what
there I was a correct enjoyed answer.
Yeah, there was a correct answer, and it wasn't what I wrote down. And so I think there's that, and that's what, like, when Current goes through her dilemma, that's kind of it's the same sort of thought process where nothing that I've ever learned has prepared me for anything like this. I have no, you know, like, and the only two, it's like there are only two poles. You can either go and whistleblow immediately and, you know, like try and do exactly the right thing, or you completely just brush it under the rug and ignore everything and sort of join in. And there's no room for any sort of critical thinking or any, you know, anything in the middle.
True that. And she even hesitates to reach out to her ethics professor because she's like, what does this person know about the real world?
Yeah,
and that's something I see. This is why I'm asking you about this, because it's something I do relate to as a philosophy teacher. And when it comes to ethics particularly, I have two problems always. One, it's either I cannot get people to so much as even consider ethical issues. They're like, who cares? If it's legal and I ask the compliance people, that's good, I'm good, I don't care. Or they take the ethics part too seriously, just like your corporate ethics professor, where they have to have the right answer. Like, it's this. And there's almost always no in between, kind of, where life is a gray area in a way.
Yeah. Yeah. Which, and this brings us back to critical thinking. I mean, and that's what, like, I think that's why I'm excited for your, like, what you're doing now with the business for, or business for philosophers, no, philosophy for business people, because that's what people need to be able to do, is to think and to ask these questions and not just say, oh, well, you know, I did a case study about this. That means, you know, here's the answer. Like, the answer is never, there is no black and white. Like, there's never a black or a white answer. It's always going to be in gray. And the more comfortable we can get with the gray, and the more we, yeah, like the more shades of gray that we've been exposed to, the better. And that was not a 50 Shades of Grey reference.
I'm already thinking about other things now, but but you're right. And this is why I also like the book. Maybe now I'm thinking about this, because it's not prescriptive. So you're not, you know, it's not your it's not like and not to insult the book, but it's not like your typical now movies and Disney and everything where you have to think this way, or it's just presenting a story and you're just exploring all the ramifications of the events that keep happening, and that's it. So there is no, oh, this is the right thing or this is the wrong thing, this is what she did, and that's it.
Yeah.
And yeah. This is extremely important. Like, you're not telling me what to think or how to think about the story or whether this is good or this is bad, or it's, so we can even have a discussion. Like, I'm now thinking, yeah, you can have a like this book with the details. You can have a book club and then discuss it and see what everyone thinks. Did she do the right thing? Does this? What would you have done in that place, or what happened here, etc. So it's interesting. Like, it gives food for thought. I'm looking at you, and you're like, what is this guy saying?
No, this is so I'm really, really, really excited that you're saying this, because this is, so when I was in high school and we were studying like English literature and poetry and stuff, and we were supposed to write these essays on, you know, like, what was the author saying here? You know, like, he interwove this theme of redemption throughout the entire novel and all of this stuff. And I got into trouble because I asked my teacher, and I was like, why don't we just ask him what he meant? And they were like, no, you can't, like, no, that's not how it works. Like, you can't just ask the author what he meant. And I was like, well, he wrote it. Like, he should know what themes he put into it. And then, like, now that I'm actually, that I write books, like, I had no idea that I put that theme in there. But that is sort of my personal, like, we all need to make decisions for ourselves. And I think the worst thing you can do, no, okay, that's not fair. But what I don't like is when I see people who have to take a stand on everything, where it's not just, here's this decision, you know, like, here's an ethical dilemma that I am facing at work. And instead of just dealing with this dilemma and moving on, I'm going to turn this into a global, you know, like a global issue, and I must solve this issue, you know, for the company and for the world right now. And I must, like, sacrifice myself and make a huge, I don't know, like, things are not everything is a big deal. Not everything has to be a huge deal. And that is, so if that's how I feel, and that's what came across in the book without me, like, purposefully, you know, sitting down and one of my bullet points in my outline saying, like, now put in personal philosophy about, you know, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, no.
Then that's, I'm pretty happy.
Yeah, it's, see, maybe I'm reading too much into it as well. I don't know.
Reading, I like what you're reading into it. So that's okay.
No, it's, see, this is, and it gives me a lot of, at least personally, like, it's, it gives me a lot of ideas also to think about. The case studies, when it comes to case studies, and you're an MBA in an MBA program, and they teach you, see, this is I think philosophy is important, and that's why I wrote today what I wrote. I sent out another kind of newsletter/short article I wrote about the Philosophy for Professionals workshop I'm organizing. And my dilemma, or my, the problem I'm facing is, people either associate philosophy with intellectuals who are too abstract and dissociated from the world, or with ideological kind of stances where this is how you think, or they're either detached or they're too attached. And my issue is, I want to use philosophy. Like, I've been thinking maybe I can remove philosophy, but no, Hassan told me this is your points of strength. This is what you do. This is your expertise. But then the kind of philosophy I do is neither this nor that. It's where I don't teach you what to think and I don't give you answers. It's more of an let's explore. And so this is why I wrote what I wrote today. Philosophy, as I see it, is a mental gymnasium space, kind of, where is it going to be useful? Are you going to be applying all these formulas when you have problems? Well, no. But do you lift heavy logs in your real life? And this is why you train at the gym? No, you train because you want to be fit, and this will help you do other things in the real world. And so similarly, philosophy, it trains you how to think about things like be prepared. And so when you're mentioning MBA, case studies, etc., it looks like you guys are trained to think about the answer. Is this the case?
I think so. And in a lot of business environments and corporate environments and most environments, really, you don't have the luxury of just contemplation. There's always you have to do something. Like, something has to happen. You have to make a decision. Even when the best decision is to not do anything at all, but everything is about execution. And so the metaphor that you're using is really good. You don't go to the gym just to, you go to the gym to be prepared to execute things in real life, movements in real life. And so that's why, we were talking about this, I think, earlier before we turned where we pushed record, but I'm super excited about this new course, because that's what people need in your brand of philosophy. So I've taken, I don't know, two or three courses with you, and I hate philosophy. And I think I told you that, I don't like philosophy. I don't like asking questions just for the sake of asking questions. But and every, I had taken a couple of philosophy classes in college, and it was, like you said, it was all about remembering which name went to which, approach, and all of these big words and all of these, kind of thought experiments that never went anywhere. But your, the way that you do it is, it is much more about, I still have no idea, who Hegel is or what he said, or anybody. I don't know any of the names, but I know a lot of the concepts and more how they apply in day-to-day life. And if you can bring that to the marketplace, to business people, and that starts trickling down, that's going to be amazing. And now, yeah, I just put a lot more responsibility on your shoulders, and I know how much you like that. So
no, the responsibility is the challenge here is and having them learn or to explain what or to present philosophy as you explained it, because there are already preconceptions about what philosophy is, and I'm trying to just challenge this. So I'm not your typical corporate ethics professor, and I'm not your typical, ideological kind of political philosophy activist guy. I'm just here to, instead of the case studies where I'm going to be giving you the answer, we're going to be thinking about it. And I think this is, that's a question I would want to ask, and then would Current have benefited from a space during their MBA program where, instead of figuring out how to answer a case study, they would just sit down and explore their different viewpoints about a particular case study.
I don't know if Current would have benefited from something like that in MBA school, because she still would have been so caught up in this, you know, imposter syndrome, impressing everybody, trying to, you know, like, she wouldn't have been in the right place for it. But a few years in, like, once, I think, I kind of hope we all go through this where, you know, we get into a new job or a new situation and the imposter syndrome is super, super high. And then we, at some point, get a little bit more comfortable and then it kind of ebbs. And so once people get into that, you know, get over the initial hump and are a little more comfortable, I think that's when it would be really helpful to have a place where you can talk about different viewpoints and just introducing the idea that it's okay to think about something and not just mimic what everyone else around you is saying. That right there, that is enough value for it to be worthwhile.
Yeah, that's the mimicking bit, you know, it's an entire kind of, is it Rene Girard and these people, you know, the mimesis? I don't know if who wrote about this, but we did discuss this as well.
Girard.
Yesterday. It's interesting that,
can we just pause here? Like, this is the one, like, I've never been able to, like, actually put a name to a concept before. And I can't remember. I think it's Rene Girard. I was going to I didn't even remember his first name, but so I'm very proud of that reference.
Great. You're on your way to becoming an actual philosopher. So, because you're reflecting on your experience, and yeah, so it's and we can wrap up with this. It's because I've been kind of bringing up the topics about the book, but how would you like, what did you like about the book? Or a particular thing that you really like about, or a particular topic or something?
I think what I like about the book, I had so much fun writing it and reading it. I mean, that's part of the reason I loved making the audiobook, is just rereading it. And it's because I never ever set out to make it serious. I never set out for this to be, you know, the next great American novel. I never set out for it to be studied in English literature classes. Like, my goal was that someone would pick this up on a, you know, like a 4-hour and 42-minute plane ride home some Thursday, and it would be enough to keep them entertained. Or they would, you know, be sitting by a beach on vacation. And it was just, I just wanted something lighthearted and entertaining and funny. And it would have been, you know, like, and it would be great if it sparked a couple of thoughts as well. And if, especially if it was something like, hey, okay, I'm not the only person who has these, you know, the mismatch between internal dialogue and what I actually say in meetings, and, you know, if it can help somebody. But I mean, I don't take myself too seriously. Current takes herself very seriously, but she's going to learn how to not take herself so seriously. And I hope the book helps other people to not take themselves so seriously.
Yeah, which is quite a challenge, to be honest. And it is lighthearted. It is entertaining. It was really fun to listen to. So, yeah. And I mean, I'm now thinking that there's a sequel, and I'm going to be now taking all the pressure off my back and throwing it at you and saying, when is the second book coming out? But no, I'm joking.
Yeah,
I'm joking.
Well, I mean, there are 497 words of it so far, so...
this is more than enough. I mean, you've already kind of gotten over the blank page syndrome and the writer's block and whatever they call these. And if, and that the last question in my case, if you, so let's say, you're on a train and there's someone next to you, and you have a free copy, you have a copy of the book, like you have the book with you. In addition to just giving them the book for free, how would you convince them to take a look at your book? Like, what would you say?
That is making me second guess myself, because like with my kids' books, I give them to a lot of people for free, and I assume that was enough. Like, if someone hands you a free book, you're going to look at it, right? Like, I didn't know I had to do a sales pitch with it.
But this is the thing. It's like, how can you like make me all hooked to read the book immediately?
Oh, this is... Wow. Yeah, no, because like that is a huge part of my marketing. It's just that, like, here, do you want this book? Like, you can have it. Like, if you will read it, like, I'll give it to you for free, which I shouldn't be telling your listeners, because I would like them to pay for it. But so the tagline, this is on the website and everywhere the book is marketed, is no one is their authentic self at work. And so I don't know how I would, if I was on a train next to someone, I don't know how I would, like, I couldn't just go up to them and like hand them the book and say, no one is their authentic self at work. Although if, or I did, it would probably works. Make quite an impression. Yeah.
Yeah. You'll be like, have you ever felt like you don't know what you're talking about and that everyone else, no, that doesn't work either.
I think what I could do is, if I'm on a train, like in the in the first class section where there's all the people with their laptops, and I can just say like, oh, I overheard you on that last Zoom call. I think you should read this book.
Okay. Yeah. It's you can tell them, if you want to, or without spoiling, try not to be a Beck.
Yeah, no, that's really good. And then they'll have to, yeah, I like that, because it's got the curiosity. It'll be like, who is Beck and why can't I be like him?
Or
I'll already be off the train by the time they realize.
Why do I need to try not to be like him? Yeah. And you'll be like, because I'm current and I'll be coming for you. if you don't leave a review, that's unethical. Yeah,
exactly.
That would be interesting. Yeah, no, thank you very much, Megan, for this. I enjoyed the chat,
and yeah, me too.
I enjoyed listening to the book, and it shows that you enjoyed writing the book as well. And I'm really not exaggerating. Like, that's for those still listening, I am really not exaggerating. It was a fun listen, and yeah, I'm looking forward to the sequel. And so far as it's an audiobook, again, I have too much screen time that I'm just listening to books nowadays. It's easier. And it's cool that you also recorded it. So, you know, like, this is, you know, the, like, you capture the inner dialogue and everything, like the tone and everything. So it's also fun, because if someone else, maybe like with nonfiction books, it doesn't matter. But then with fiction books, it always helps to embody the tone and the different kind of voices going around, like the different personalities, etc. So yeah, that was cool. Where can people find you, and where can people find the book, even though we mentioned a bit? And I'm going to be posting this right around the time it's going to be, wait a second, let's do that now, even while, so it's 11, we can discuss this, but then the week of the 11th. So yeah, where can people find you, the book, etc.?
So you can find me on LinkedIn, Twitter, and Instagram. My name is Megan Prestonmeyer. Twitter and Instagram are M Prestonmeyer. And you can also just ask Mahmoud, because he'll be able to put you in touch with me. Yeah, you will know where I am at any given time. And then you can find out more about the book on, so it will be all over my socials. It's also, there's a website, www.alpinechalet.coffee. And it's also, it's on Amazon, it's on Audible, it's anywhere books are sold. So bookshops.org. It's also like the audiobook is also, I think, on Spotify and some other, like, basically any place you can get audiobooks, you should be able to find it.
Yeah. Interesting. Yeah. It's on Audible. Even though I pre-ordered the Amazon Kindle one, I'll order the book again. The Audible one, I'll have it in my library. I'll listen to it again. And maybe I'll even assign it for December, the book club discussion, and have you join the discussion.
That would be, well, yeah, we'll that'd be awesome. About that.
Yeah. I think the people will enjoy it. And this way I'll be like, hey, you have to read this book. And so they cannot say no. I mean, yeah. Thank you very much for joining me today, Megan. And thank you, everyone, for listening. And do buy the book. It's really interesting. So, yeah. Cheers.
Thank you. Yep.